and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. 14 years ago today, the first detainee arrived at Guantanamo Bay prison camp. Obama pledged to close the torture center as soon as he came into office, but in his final year, it remains open. Now, Republican candidates are calling on President Obama to open Guantanamo for new detainees. It's been 5 years today since the earthquake and tsunami that triggered the Fukushima nuclear disaster one day later. But what is life like now for those affected by the disaster? And is the United States prepared for a similar situation if it were to occur here? What are the lessons unlearned from Fukushima? Today marks the 2 years since Crimea declared independence from Ukraine. Just days later, voters went to the polls in a referendum in which 96.7% of the people voted to join or rejoin Russia. Today, Western powers continue to say Crimea is part of Ukraine and was annexed by Russia. But what was really behind the declaration of independence? First, though, we turn to Guantanamo. We are joined by Jeremy Varon, an activist with Witness Against Torture and an associate professor of history at the New School in New York. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
14 years, and even more importantly, I'd say, it's been more than 7 years now since President Obama came into office and pledged that this blemish on America, the torture center, as the UN recognized it to be, would be closed, and it's still open. What are the prospects?
The prospects of it closing are dim. Obama finally sent a plan to Congress for closing the prison that Congress had requested, and everybody from the Republican leadership to the media declared it, you know, dead on arrival. So again, the prospects are very dim that it will close before he leaves office. There are congressional bans on moving any detainee to the United States. And Obama seems reticent to use executive authority to override that act of Congress. So right now we have basically a failed policy on life support.
So talk about the president's executive authority, the executive authority to act. I mean, here you have a facility that the United Nations and the whole world recognizes to be a torture center. I mean, torture is illegal. The United States is a signatory to the Treaty Against Torture. Thus, the maintenance of this torture center is in violation not only of international law and certainly international public opinion and morality, it's also in violation of U.S. law. Doesn't President Obama have actual executive authority to act, to shut it down?
I mean, it's worth recalling that it was opened by executive fiat. And then, you know, we have always maintained so, too, it can be closed by executive fiat if, you know, common sense has any standing anymore. Obama has talked of invoking executive authority to determine the location of prisoners under the laws of war. So to the extent that they would, you know, seriously explore closing it by executive authority, it would be a separation of powers argument saying that the commander in chief and not Congress has the authority to determine how prisoners of war are, you know, captured. You know, however, the attorney general, his own attorney general, said that such a move would be a violation of standing law. And then somebody high up in the Defense Department said that the Defense Department wouldn't act contrary to the will of Congress. So the administration can't even get on the same page regarding this issue. And then nobody has talked about closing it because it's a human rights abomination and a place where illegal things happen. I agree, of course, with your reasoning, but that's not the way it's talked about in Beltway circles.
Unfortunately, when something becomes in the news, in the press, over and over and over again, 4 years, now it's the 14th anniversary since the first people arrived in Guantanamo. Guantanamo has been talked about endlessly. After a while, people become a little bit desensitized. It becomes almost like a cliche. It doesn't really have emotional impact, except for the people who are in Guantanamo, of course, for their families, their loved ones, And for people like you and others who have been paying very careful attention trying to shut down Guantanamo, so help our audience that may not really be thinking about Guantanamo, help them understand again what Guantanamo was, why it was an abomination, why it was a torture center, what happened, how many people were involved. Talk about Guantanamo, the real story.
Okay, thank you. I mean, so Guantanamo was opened on January 11, 2002 as a place to interrogate so-called war on terror detainees. It was specifically put in a place under United States military jurisdiction, but not so the Bush administration thought, subject to federal law, to in effect strip the detainees of any rights within the federal U.S. legal system, and also without any rights within international law. Rumsfeld and Bush declared that the Geneva Conventions were quaint. They didn't apply because this was a new kind of combatant, indeed an enemy combatant, who had no standing in any global or national legal system. And then it's important to note that Guantanamo was never about gathering evidence to put people on trial. It wasn't about justice for the 9/11 families. It was always conceived as a place of withering and brutal interrogations to try to get intelligence, you know, presumably useful to the United States in the war on terror. But it failed even in that goal, insofar as torture has been demonstrated again and again and again, is not a source of reliable information. In fact, torture helps produce false confessions. So what Guantanamo has been for years and years has been a concentration camp for exclusively Muslim men, where people of mostly no discernible threat to the United States and zero intelligence value to the United States military are being held in a miserable open-ended detention simply because we can't figure out politically how to send them away from the base. And then a very powerful definition of the place was recently provided by Shakir Amer, a UK resident who was released after 13 years of incarceration. And he said that the purpose of Guantanamo is to destroy human beings. That's its only intent. There's an elaborate series of rules and regulations, a kind of draconian sort of daily regime of surveillance and persecution of the men there. That's to destroy their spirit and to destroy their souls. People have protested in Guantanamo for years, often through the method of hunger striking. And the response to hunger striking is to force feed them. And some people have been force fed literally thousands of times over a period of years in a very brutal practice where, you know, plastic tubes are rammed down their throats. And the people who have subjected to this say that they feel as though they're dying. They feel as though they are suffering a living death. And then another important description of Guantanamo, and I'll close here, is by a former guard who exposed unreported circumstances about the death of three folks in 2006. And he thinks that Guantanamo is fundamentally a place to experiment with exotic sort of avant-garde techniques of psychological warfare as the United States moves into a new pattern of global wars on terror, that it's, in a sense, a laboratory to experiment in ways of manipulating and destroying the human spirit, consciousness, and soul. So all of that is terribly sinister. We try to dramatize the suffering that has occurred there, to traumatize the suffering that continues to occur there, to, you know, shock the conscience again, to awaken people out of complacency and recognize that, you know, it does matter that nearly 100 men are still subjected to this. And that it's, you know, an unbearable disgrace for the United States to, you know, keep the place open.
I want to talk a little bit more about who was there, because I believe that the number of people who were actually convicted through any sort of trial, either a military trial or whatever legal or semi-legal or pretend legal process is going on, the number of convictions, I think, is 6 or 7. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. That would mean that 95% of the people there were never convicted of anything. So how did they end up in Guantanamo? Who are the people in the main? Of course, I know there's not just one group or one category of prisoners, but how did people get there?
Right. A variety of means. I mean, you know, when the United States invaded Afghanistan, there were a lot of people from around the world, the Arab world, but the Muslim world more broadly, living in Afghanistan. And then they were, you know, fleeing warfare. And then a bunch of them got picked up in essentially a dragnet where the United States paid bounty to individuals, to individual warlords, or even to the government of Pakistan to turn over captives to the United States. And then, and, you know, a large percentage of the population was, again, picked up in this very, very sloppy dragnet. There were no hearings to determine their status. And interestingly, during the first Gulf War, the United States captured lots and lots of people, and in the battlefield would have summary but meaningful hearings to determine if they caught a civilian or an actual combatant. And many people were released because they came to the conclusion that they weren't actually, you know, didn't actually have a combatant in custody. And then there were a number of people who were low-level fighters affiliated with or vaguely affiliated with the Taliban. And then the Taliban was a sovereign state that had a national army fighting in an actual war against the United States as an invading army. And then you don't detain, interrogate, torture, strip of all rights, you know, a prisoner from an opposing army. So some people, you know, were simply fighters in some small way connected to American hostilities in a sort of conventional military conflict, and then thrown into this hideous war on terror detention. And then, as you indicated, a minuscule percentage of the population has been convicted, is standing trial, or will stand trial. And as, you know, scholars and other researchers have looked at the population, the basic determination is that a tiny, tiny, tiny handful approach the description, worst of the worst, that Cheney used years ago to tar the whole population. And the vast majority of the people who are there should never have been there in the first place, and certainly shouldn't be held in American custody today. And then there's some people who are there simply on the basis of mistaken identity. And then not long ago, the United States revealed that it held for 14 years a man because they literally got his name wrong. And this is on CNN, The Guardian, you know, reputable news sources. So there are cases as absurd, Kafkaesque, and macabre as that.
Talk about Guantanamo itself. It is in Cuba. I mean, why does the United States, how is the United States able to maintain a prison? Not to even mention again that it was determined to be a torture center in another country, in Cuba. Obviously, Cuba doesn't want the Guantanamo prison facility or the American presence there. How did the United States end up in Guantanamo?
Well, it was very deliberately selected. It is a site that, to the sort of architects of the policy, would be beyond the reach of federal law, certainly not under Cuban sovereignty. Part of no nation, so to speak, and hence a legal black hole. And there were these years and years of litigation where the Supreme Court finally ruled that for the purpose of this body of the law, the United States, Guantanamo is territorially part of the United States, that it is, you know, part of the sort of meaningful sovereignty of America. And then, you know, the courts restored certain rights that had been stripped from them. So there's a legal rationale for placing it there. And then also there's a sense of, you know, out of sight, out of mind. It's this offshore gulag that has very minimal physical representation in the sort of imagination of Americans. The population is completely hidden. They can't lawfully be photographed. No journalist can interview men in prison in face-to-face interviews. And then it's a population, you know, about which, or who we were designed not to see. And then the idea is that if they're sort of cloaked in invisibility, we can do horrendous things to them without any system of transparency and accountability. And then the Cubans deeply resent the American occupation of the naval base altogether. And they consider it, you know, a terrible insult to the injury of occupation that a hideous human rights abuse is being perpetrated on their soil. And then with sadness, Cuban officials watched planes fly in over Cuban airspace, bringing war and terror detainees to a pocket the United States essentially stolen from Cuba, in which all Cubans want the United States to vacate. So that's another sort of terrible geopolitical dimension of this tragedy.
Yeah, it's really something when you think about it, how Guantanamo is, in a way, the expression of empire and the exemption of by empire of itself from international law, from Geneva Convention. But also, it's the empire that started to take root with the so-called Spanish-American War in 1898, where the United States actually seized Puerto Rico, seized the Philippines, seized Guam, and seized Cuba, and then made the arrangement whereby the United States signed a treaty that the Cuban government at that time was forced to sign under the conditions of occupation that allowed the United States to claim Guantanamo, a piece of Cuba, for itself forever until the United States decides it no longer wants it. I mean, it is the sort of the basest expression, I think, of colonialism and the continuation of it. And as you've said, a real abomination. I wanted to ask you also, you're part of Witness Against Torture. I want to talk about torture, too, because I interviewed John Kiriakou. He's the only CIA officer and, in fact, the only American who ever went to prison for torture, but not because he tortured, but because he exposed the fact that the United States was torturing. Talk about Witness Against Torture and how is it that the United States government came to exempt itself from the international laws that forbid torture?
Right. I mean, so the group formed in 2005 when a bunch of people, 25 in all, went to Cuba and then held a demonstration as close to the American naval base as they could get. And then we reprised that trip last November in a sort of Thanksgiving time trip to Cuba. And then many of the members of the group come out of the Catholic worker tradition. And, you know, left-wing Catholics were very active in Latin America in the, you know, 1980s. So there's in the culture of the group a sort of memory of and direct connection to resistance to U.S.-sponsored use of torture to suppress popular insurgencies in Latin America in the 80s and, you know, the 90s. So it's an issue that had been sort of part of the conscience and activist resume of many of the people who founded, Witness Against Torture. And then, you know, as you well know, the United States selectively exempts itself from international law when it constrains the conduct of the American military and, you know, intelligence apparatus. And then as the Convention on Torture was amended at the United States' insistence in the 80s and 90s, language was put in that would conceivably make forms of psychological torture permissible. And then Alfred has written extensively about how the United States tried to hold on to the right of torture without violating necessarily the letter of that agreement. And then, you know, any legal scholar of note or common sense judge of American conduct would say that it plainly committed torture. Dianne Feinstein, in the preface to the Senate torture report, said the United States committed torture and committed crime.
We're out of time. We're going to have to pick it up there. We've been speaking to Jeremy Varon. He is a truth teller and organizer. Someone, along with the Witness Against Torture folks, have been trying to shut down Guantanamo. He's also an associate professor of history at the New School in New York. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. And clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. We are joined by Damon Moglen. He is a senior strategic advisor at Friends of the Earth. Welcome, Damon. We're talking about Fukushima 5 years later. Welcome to Loud and Clear.
Well, thank you for having me and getting an opportunity to talk about this incredibly important and terrible topic of Fukushima 5 years on.
You know, it seems like yesterday, in some ways, I mean, it was such a huge disaster, but because it hasn't really been, at least in the U.S. media, I want to review just the basic facts of what happened 5 years ago at Fukushima and then right afterwards, and then we'll get into some of the other issues if you could.
Well, sure. So 5 years ago, as I think most listeners will remember, there was an absolutely devastating earthquake off the coast of Japan and a resultant tsunami. And in the course of that, there was an absolutely staggering triple meltdown at this large nuclear reactor site at Fukushima. There were meltdowns at three nuclear reactors. That means that highly radioactive fuel in the reactors actually were allowed not to be cooled. The reactors broke down. They were not getting cooled. The fuel burned its way through the bottom of the reactors, three of them. There were explosions at those reactors, and radioactive gases were vented into the environment. Somewhere in and around 200,000 people surrounding that area were ultimately evacuated, having themselves been contaminated. But because the company TEPCO involved was not forthcoming with what was really going on and about the meltdown at the reactors, it's actually believed that millions of people received radioactive contamination burns. And in turn, since then, the then Prime Minister of Japan basically said that he was on the verge of calling for the evacuation of Tokyo. So this is an absolutely extraordinary nuclear disaster. And honestly, in part because of the unwillingness of the company to be honest with the population, then and even now, we don't fully appreciate the tremendous damage that was being done and even about the radioactive contamination that occurred.
I read an article when researching about Fukushima on this, the fifth anniversary, that there were three major problems in addition to all of the, there's actually hundreds of problems, but three major problems that this writer identified. The three reactor cores were missing. Radiated water had been leaking from the plant in mass quantities for years after the event 5 years ago. And 11,000 spent nuclear fuel rods, perhaps the most dangerous things ever created by humans, are stored in the plant and still needed to be removed. Have any of those problems been resolved? And are those actually problems?
Well, unfortunately and remarkably, none of those problems has actually been, quote, solved. And each and every one of them in its own right makes up a nuclear disaster of an absolutely horrific level. The fact that we're now 5 years down and we still have no idea what's really happened or even what's happening inside of those three damaged nuclear reactors where there were meltdowns, the fact that we don't even know, let alone that we haven't gotten to the fuel, means that that fuel is still in the earth, is still potentially coming into contact, as you said, with the tremendous amount of water that is still flowing into, through the site and into the ocean. And in turn, extraordinarily, the spent nuclear fuel, the irradiated nuclear fuel rods from the reactors that were stored at the site, those have not been removed either. So all of these things are still, in effect, ongoing as nuclear crises at the Fukushima site. And it's really quite devastating when you think that here's one of the most advanced countries on the planet in terms of dealing with nuclear technology, and 5 years down the line, they actually haven't been able to address any of these major problems. In a sense, the Fukushima nuclear disaster is still going on.
Yeah, and let's talk about the overall sort of takeaway, not only for Japan, but the rest of the world, because as you say, of course, many people, millions of people in Japan were angry about what TEPCO, the proprietary company, did or didn't do or what it didn't say, the fact that it wasn't forthcoming. And also there are other complaints about what the Japanese government didn't do. But you can't make the argument that Japan has the reputation of being a non-meticulous country, a disorganized country, a country that doesn't pay a lot of attention to things like nuclear safety provisions. In other words, by measure of the other countries in the world, Japan is not at the low rank. It's probably in the higher tier. So what are the lessons for the rest of the world? If this kind of catastrophe, which you said is continuing, it's ongoing, it hasn't been solved, some of it may be in fact getting worse, what is the takeaway about these technologies for the rest of the world or specifically for the United States?
Sure. Well, I would certainly say that the first thing that Fukushima really proves is that this is too dangerous a technology for us to be relying on for our energy. We simply have safer, cleaner, cheaper energy in renewable energy, energy efficiency, and energy storage resources. That, in a sense, this is a failed technology of the 20th century that has done absolutely devastating damage to people and the planet. And we need to recognize that this is a failed technology of the last century, and we need to put it behind us. Having said that, I think that another major lesson of Fukushima is that the nuclear industry, far too often in various countries, is not adequately supervised by an independent safety agency. In Japan, the then prime minister has talked very eloquently about the way in which the nuclear industry worked hand in hand, hand in pocket, if you will, with the government regulators. And unfortunately, we have exactly that same kind of problem here in the United States and in many other countries, be it Russia, et cetera. As you may know, when Barack Obama was running for the presidency for the first time, he referred to our Nuclear Regulatory Commission as a captured agency. How completely right he is. Unfortunately, the commissioners of the NRC, who are supposed to be looking out for all of us and assuring that it's an independent agency, in fact, it's the opposite. Basically, the NRC acts to facilitate and support the ongoing activities of the nuclear industry and is really almost a toothless policeman when it comes to nuclear safety in our country. And it's a very scary situation. And then I would say that among the other lessons we have to realize is that if you're going to run nuclear facilities, you've got to put the money in to make them safe, and that basically makes them absolutely uneconomic. And we need to realize that there are just certain places where we shouldn't be running nuclear reactors. The idea that you would be running nuclear reactors in places that are highly seismically active with the risk of tsunami, it's just dumb. It's that simple. It's dumb.
At the time of the Fukushima meltdown, tsunami, the terrible tragedy, a third of the U.S. nuclear reactors, at that time at least, were the same as those operating at Fukushima. What's happened to those reactors since Fukushima? Has there been anything that's been done, any emergency action taken so that something like what happened there would not happen here? And talk about the fact that the technology that was used in Fukushima isn't strictly or even mainly a Japanese technology. There's a lot of connectivity between U.S. manufacturers and the nuclear plants, both in Japan and in the United States.
Well, that's absolutely right. One of the really stunning things about the outcome of Fukushima is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and many government officials in this country spent a lot more time downplaying the nature of the disaster rather than addressing the similar problems that we have with our reactors in this country that led to the Fukushima disaster. As you raised, nearly a third of the reactors in this country are of a similar era, similar design to that which failed at Fukushima. And I think it's fair to say that virtually nothing has been done to change the design, upgrade the safety of those reactors in this country. The NRC launched a supposed program of, quote, Fukushima lessons learned, end quote. And it's basically just been a go slow road to nowhere. The recommendations that have been made by some of the staff who have really wanted to get real things done were rejected. We're in a situation in which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission seems to have been spending a lot of time trying to figure out how to propagandize the public and make us think that this couldn't happen here, whereas, of course, it can happen here. Unfortunately, until we have a regulatory agency that sees its job as policing this industry rather than facilitating it, we're really at risk of exactly the same kind of disaster in this country. And ultimately, the nuclear industry here is really not different from the nuclear industry in Japan.
The nuclear energy and the nuclear energy technologies were developed by the U.S. government. That was during World War II with the Manhattan Project, the development of the atomic bomb, the bombs that were used in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. After the war, a lot of that technology was handed over to private corporations for the purposes of manufacturing nuclear energy plants. Talk about the connection, not just about the NRC, the monitoring agency, the oversight agency, but the role of profit, from privately owned big transnational but U.S.-based corporations in terms of the promotion of this technology, the sort of idea that this technology is the technology. And as a follow-up to that, after Three Mile Island in mid-Pennsylvania, I guess it was 1979 or 1980, and then the Chernobyl tragedy in the mid-1980s, was there a move away from nuclear technology? And if so, what's the role of the corporate entities that are actually profiting from it?
Well, those are two very big questions. First of all, historically, as you've pointed out, the United States played a critical role in designing nuclear reactor technology as a way of producing basic nuclear weapons material, both uranium and plutonium. So this technology grew out of the development of nuclear weaponry. But in time, it was felt that this technology was going to be the source of a tremendous amount of power, and that gave birth to the Atoms for Peace program under the Eisenhower administration. And really, in the 1950s and 1960s, this gave birth to this whole idea that nuclear power was going to be too cheap to monitor, it was going to be essentially safe. And very quickly, people began to realize that that's indeed not true, that the cost overruns at these nuclear power plants in the 1970s led to a situation that by the mid-1980s, you weren't building any more of these reactors. You were finishing off the ones you had. So we in this country are actually in a very scary situation in that we have about 99 reactors operating in the United States, and all but one of them are actually older than 30 years. And I would, you know, ask your viewers, to your listeners, to just think about what piece of technology in your home is older than 30 years. Do you have a toaster that's older than 30 years? Do you have a car that's older than 30 years? Most of us don't have a single piece of technology that's older than 30 years. Most of us wouldn't go out and buy a piece of technology that was older 30 years. And yet we're told that these reactors, which are basically just machines operated under very demanding circumstances, are completely safe, despite the fact that by most of our way of looking at it, things designed in the 1950s are completely out of date and built in the 1960s are completely decrepit and unacceptable. So, you know, we are in a very scary situation, and that all of these reactors are reaching the end of their lifetime. And the industry, as you have been suggesting, is fighting to continue to operate the plants, because for many of these companies, this is relatively inexpensive power for them, which they're able to sell at an expensive rate to the consumer. So we're in a very dangerous situation where these reactors become more and more dangerous, more and more decrepit, and the companies involved want to keep running them because they're making a healthy profit off of them now. So that's really a major problem. And then you've asked the question about, well, you know, what have we learned after all of these nuclear accidents? And the fact of the matter is that, for example, in the aftermath of the Chernobyl disaster, the nuclear disaster in the Soviet Union or in Russia at that time, many of the European countries began the process of phasing out nuclear power. And that's where the nuclear phase out, for example, in Germany and Sweden, in various countries, was really raised as a point. And we need to realize that in many of the European countries, they are seeing nuclear power as a technology in its last period, in its last era.
Damon, let me ask you, we have about a minute and a half left. I'm looking at a document here that says it's from a former resident inspector at Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, Michael Peck. He wrote a year and a half ago, the plant's design and licensing were based on withstanding a 7.5 magnitude earthquake using a double design earthquake safety analysis. And then he suggests that because of the private utility company and because of lax oversight by the NRC, the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactor is in peril. Talk about that in our last minute or minute and 15 seconds, if you could. And what's the significance of that?
Well, Dr. Peck is a senior resident inspector for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and he showed very clearly that Because of what we now know about the earthquake surrounding Diablo Canyon, that the reactor is no longer operating with the design characteristics of its license. And Dr. Peck was basically saying that, you know, this raises serious regulatory problems for an agency that's supposed to be policing a situation. They understand that they've got a problem, and yet they're not doing anything about it. And incredibly, even the agency has said that they recognize that there's a problem here. But now they've just asked for an additional study, which is going to be back in another couple of years. So it's part and parcel of the complete unwillingness of the leadership at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to do its job and to police this industry. And it's a very scary situation.
We have been joined by Damon Maughlin. He is a senior strategic advisor at Friends of the Earth. Mr. Maughlin, if people want to find out about Friends of the Earth, can you tell us your website, if you would?
Absolutely. People should go to www.foe for Friends of the Earth, but it's www.foe.org, and you can find out about our nuclear campaign there.
Okay, and I hope our listeners do. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. Today marks 2 years since the Republic of Crimea declared independence from Ukraine. Just days later, voters went to the polls in a referendum in which 96.7% voted to join Russia. Today, only six countries recognize Crimea as part of Russia, with many of the Western powers continuing to say it was annexed. We are joined in studio here in Washington, D.C., by Ray McGovern, a former CIA officer, foreign policy critic of the United States government, a political commentator, and he has his website, raymcgovern.com. Welcome, Ray McGovern.
Thank you, Brian.
So let's just talk about this anniversary. Of course, as you know, it's been portrayed in the West and been used by those in Congress who have declared more money for the military budget, that this was an act of aggression by Russia, the annexation, unprovoked. Tell your version of what you think happened with Crimea.
Well, Brian, as you know, I get all my information from the unassailable font of wisdom and truth, the Washington Post. And I actually came across an article from the Washington Post exactly 2 years ago. And it, you know, gives the lie to say that I'm being facetious here. Let me be serious. Here's the title of this article. Putin had early plan to annex Crimea. First sentence. Vladimir Putin has described a secret meeting with officials in February 2014, during which Russia decided it would take the Crimean Peninsula. He met with his security officials on the 23rd of February, almost a month before the referendum in Crimea. And Moscow has said that it was because that was the basis for annexing the region. Well, okay. So he met with his top security officials on February 23rd. Now, I go around the country and I talk at colleges and some very sophisticated people. And I say, okay, is there anything wrong with that article? And they say, well, what happened the day before? I don't know. What happened on the 22nd of February? Nobody knows. The 22nd of February is when there was what George Friedman of Stratfor called the most blatant coup in human history. Why? It was advertised 2.5 weeks before on YouTube. And the Ukraine got a new government because of a putsch, a coup that was mounted with U.S., of course, Western help and proto-fascists. And the duly elected government in Ukraine was removed in that manner on the 22nd of February. So I have to say that I'm not an apologist for Vladimir Putin. But, but if you put yourself in his shoes, I mean, I would be derelict in my duty were not to convene my military and security officials and say, whoa, the first thing that Yatsenyuk has said, he wants to join NATO. What does that mean for Crimea? What does that mean for our sole warm water port that we've had since Catherine the Great? What does this mean for the West coming in there and take that on? So if I hadn't convened a meeting and tried to figure out what to do about Crimea, I would have been incapable of good leadership. So that's what happened. It started on the 22nd of February with the coup, not on the 23rd with Putin's reaction.
So we had a situation, and it's good, and I'm glad you reminded people about the coup on February 22nd, because there was an agreement between various international powers, including Russia, and the opposition to Yanukovych, the then-elected government in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. There was an agreement that there would be a diminution of presidential powers, there would be early elections, there'd be regional autonomy. In other words, there was an agreement to end the continuing protests that had become more and more violent and bloody. And the next day, February 22nd, fascists, and I'm not saying that rhetorically, these were people dressed in Nazi-like uniforms, neo-Nazis or semi-fascists, seized the power. They drove the parliament out. They drove Yanukovych out. And you're saying Putin then looked at, okay, Crimea, where the Russian fleet was and had been based for, as you said, Catherine, the time of Catherine the Great, that something had to be done. But was it an annexation? In other words, there was a referendum. What about the feelings of people in Crimea? Were they simply a pawn in other people's game? Were they a pawn on somebody's geostrategic chessboard?
That's a really good question, Brian. Without going back all the way to the 8th century or 9th century AD, where it was Kiev that was the center of all Slavic civilization, let's just go back to, Catherine the Great, when that warm water port was opened for the leadership in Moscow and St. Petersburg later. This was something that was fought over. This was something that they really needed. And to think that they would blithely sit back and say, gosh, we lost out on that one. These were strategic national interests involved. And if anyone in the White House or the State Department or the CIA was surprised, that Russia would react very, very strongly to the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO on the one hand, or having a ballistic missile system set up in the Black Sea and using Sevastopol, the naval port in Crimea. If anyone was surprised by what Putin did, those people don't have any sense of Russian history or Russian strategic interests. When it was, a month later, when Vladimir Putin, President Putin, in one of these marathon interviews that he holds, he answers questions from everybody throughout Russia. It's called Direct Line. He said this, and I'll quote, it's just two sentences. "I'll use this chance to say a few words about our talks about missile defense with the United States. This issue is no less, and probably even more important, than NATO's eastward expansion. Incidentally, our decision on Crimea was partially prompted by this." What does he mean? Well, he explains it. He said the point is that Crimea protrudes out into the Black Sea. It's the center. And if NATO troops walk in, they'll immediately deploy these forces there, and such a move would be geopolitically sensitive for us because in this case, Russia would be practically ousted from the Black Sea area. We'd be left with just a small coastline of 450 or 600 kilometers, and that's it. There it is, all spelled out a month after Crimea rejoined Russia. So if, as I say, Western strategists didn't know this, they should have sort of gone back into the record, because Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister now, and back in 2008, made it very clear to our ambassador that "niet" means "niet," and the discussion was about the rumors in January, February of 2008, that NATO was going to invite Crimea, Ukraine, and Georgia to be members of NATO. This is worth exploring because it's, you know, it crystallizes the whole thing. How do I know this? From a Moscow cable. Was it classified? Well, it was, but it was released by Chelsea Manning, and publicized by Julian Assange. Now, if you want extra reason why Washington hates these folks, listen to what the cable said. Bill Burns was our ambassador. That I was invited, I was actually called at the foreign ministry by Sergei Lavrov, and, you know, he sort of read the riot act to me. He said, Mr. Ambassador Burns, do you know what Nyet means? And Burns said, well, of course I do. Well, Nyet means Nyet with respect to your plans to incorporate Crimea and Georgia into NATO. If you do that, if you risk that, there will be civil war in Ukraine. We will be faced with a very difficult decision as to whether to intervene. It will be chaos. So Nyet means Nyet. Please report that back to Washington. Well, now Burns, to his credit, played it straight. The title of the cable reads, Lavrov to the Ambassador. Nyet means Nyet. Russia's red line on membership for Ukraine in NATO. Okay? Well, that was the 1st of February, 2008. On the 3rd of April, NATO convened in a summit their top leaders in Bucharest, and their declaration on the 3rd of April, 2008, said Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO. So, Nyet means Nyet. You know, what Victoria Nuland and her crop of new diplomats either didn't know or didn't care was that when they mounted that coup in Kiev on the 22nd of February 2014, that was one regime change too many, okay? Russia is not going to be played around with. Their strategic interests are immediately involved, not only because of NATO, but because of this ballistic missile defense system, which is what they really fear, because that could give the Pentagon, in their view, the notion they could have first strike, which makes the strategic equation more dangerous than it has been since 1971, right before the Ballistic Missile Treaty was signed in Moscow. And I remember that so well because I was there.
We had a referendum that took place 5 days after today, 5 days after the Declaration of Independence 2 years ago. And that referendum indicated that a very large part of the population in Crimea wanted to be connected to, be a part of Russia. They voted 96% for independence from Ukraine. Ukraine, or Crimea, was part of Russia until 1954, I believe. And correct me, Ray, if I'm wrong. In other words, when Russia and Ukraine were part of the 15 republics that made up the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, Crimea was part of Russia, and then after the death of Stalin and the transition to the new leadership, which became the Khrushchev leadership, there was a transfer that seemed to be largely administrative. In other words, it's all really within one country, the Soviet Union, but it transferred from Russia to Ukraine. Why did Khrushchev...
It was Khrushchev, he came in after Stalin. Nobody's as strong as Stalin. Khrushchev felt he needed all the possible support he could muster. And why not? He's from the Ukraine. Why not rally the support of leading Ukrainian politicians or party chiefs behind him by saying, well, what's the difference? Let's give Crimea to Ukraine. I'll get some points with the Ukrainians. And hey, doesn't matter a whit since we're all part of the Soviet Union. Well, the Berlin Wall fell, and so did the Soviet Union. And so it's an accident of history. Now, how did Khrushchev do that? By writ, by ukaz, by signing a piece of paper, okay? Now, it's a little different from holding a plebiscite. Now, the results of the plebiscite were foreordained. Everyone knew the Crimeans would vote to rejoin Russia, but at least they were given a chance to pronounce themselves before they did. and they were re-annexed. And if it came as a surprise, once again, to anybody, well, that person doesn't know much about Russian history or Soviet history or the balance of power in Central Europe.
You made it clear in your earlier comments that Victoria Nuland from the State Department and others who were part of her circle, who had been the great promoters and cheerleaders of the Maidan protests, and then after the fascist or semi-fascist coup toppled Yanukovych on February 22nd, she and John Kerry, her boss, said this was a great day, a new day, I think they said, for Ukraine. They were just, you know, in a celebratory mood. They had won. They had achieved their goal. But you said this was one regime change too many. And things changed. And Russia, of course, needed to act and did act. And the people of Crimea were certainly, according to the referendum, prepared to reaffiliate with Russia. But let's look at it 2 years later. Yes, Obama's reset button that was supposed to restore and improve relations with Russia, that's down the tube. But there is something else going on, which is that the crisis in Ukraine has been utilized by the Pentagon to carry out a very, very big escalation of troops and weapons and munitions and war exercises into the region on the basis that there must be a defense of these countries on the western border of Russia from Russian aggression. And Crimea was sort of the catalyst for that. So I'm wondering, was there or is there something about the equation which has become an incentive for at least parts of the American political establishment?
Well, not only the American, but all the Pope Francis called the blood-soaked arms dealers, okay? The blood-soaked arms makers. Let's give you a little example. There's a German arms manufacturer called Maffei, okay? They have a French affiliate, and they were commissioned to build the common European battle tank. Well, you know, all the European countries buy this. You know, from my perspective, battle tanks aren't worth the money anymore, but now they're going to build that. But get what? There was no tension. There was no enemy. You know, Maffei was, you know, really down because they couldn't get enough support to build this thing. Whoa, as soon as Ukraine went up, guess what? Their stock went up, and they and the French consortium member are building the common European battle tank. So the military-industrial complex, and I would add congressional, I would add media, I would add the deep security state, it's very real, and it's very trite to say this, but it's so real that it shouldn't be taken advantage of, and that's a large explanation as to why the tension has been stoked. After all, peace is very bad for business. War, rumors of war or tension, is very good for business. I want to say one more thing. You said, you know, reset button, all that failed. Well, whose fault is that? Whose fault is that? Now, I have to confess to having been sort of surprised this morning when Andrew Bacevich, whom I admire greatly, said on Amy Goodman's show, quote, "The notion that Putin wants to get along with the United States is absurd," period, end quote. Well, I don't think it's absurd at all. I think the record shows over the last 3-4 years that that's precisely what Putin would like to do. But he can't even get an answer from Putin. He can't even get an answer from the White House. Witness the fact that Medvedev, when he was president, he told Obama in Seoul at one of these summits, look, my friend Vladimir Putin is very concerned about anti ballistic missile systems. What are you going to do about that? And Obama was overheard on the ABC line saying, look, tell them just to give me some space. Let me get reelected and we'll do something about it. So it's a matter of trust here. They don't trust Obama, and that's really, really important.
We are out of time. I want to thank Ray McGovern and our other guests. We will be back Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.